Welcome to Ignite and Scale, where we explore the journeys of those shaping the future of business and innovation. Today, we're delighted to have David Bettley with us. David is a seasoned leader whose career spans across the automotive finance sector, from his early days with major OEMs to his current roles as chairman of Tomorrow's Journey, Credit Car and RideCharge. David also brings a wealth of knowledge from his experience as a pension trustee, offering a unique perspective on both the industry and the evolving landscape of auto finance, especially in light of recent regulatory scrutiny in the UK. Good afternoon, David. Perhaps you could summarise your successful career to date before we delve into a couple of questions I have for you.
Yeah, good afternoon, Mike. How long have you got then? So I've been in the automotive financial services industry for a very long time. People call me an industry veteran, which I'm not particularly happy about, but there you go. I can't get over that. So I started my career a long time ago as a trainee with Lloyds and Scottish Finance in Manchester, moved up the ranks pretty quickly. I was actually their youngest branch manager when I was about 25, maybe 26, and then I left there and joined International Motors to set up their finance company, really because I wanted to do a big project. And that was really exciting. That went really well. And then they asked me to move to Sweden. So I moved to Sweden. I ran the Swedish business, but Sweden, Denmark, Finland, and also the Baltic states. But then I expanded the business into Russia, which was pretty exciting. We could spend the whole afternoon telling you about what I got up to in Russia. Perhaps not. I came back from Sweden and became the managing director of Vauxhall Finance and Master Lease in the UK. And I was pretty happy there, but I got seduced by Toyota. They just kept banging on my door, and eventually I had a long conversation with my dad and I decided to join Toyota. And I was at Toyota for about 14 years, became senior vice president running Europe and Africa and also global treasury at Toyota. And I only left Toyota because they wanted me to move to Japan to take over global operations. And I've got five kids. I had four in school at the time, and I really didn't want to go to Japan. But I was also chairman of the pension scheme because I'm a qualified pension trustee. So I became 55 and I knew what I could do in the pension scheme. Toyota were very kind to me and I left Toyota. I was going to have a few months off, but within 2 weeks, my door had been knocked on again by Jaguar Land Rover. And I joined Jaguar Land Rover a couple of months after I left Toyota. She wasn't part of my master plan. And the reason Jaguar Land Rover wanted me to join them was because it was at the time when Ford had sold the business to Tata. All the financial services business globally was operated by Ford Motor Credit. Ford Motor Credit wanted out immediately. And I joined them really to manage that exit from Ford Credit, which was in some countries very difficult, and also at the same time set up new financial services businesses around the world. And the problem at the time was Jaguar Land Rover had no money. It had the credit rating that really was totally insufficient to support a finance company. So I developed a new model, and we basically had a kind of a branded white label arrangement all around the world. And the one thing that I insisted on with every partner that we had, and we ended up with about 50, was that there was one contract. Because if we had more than one contract and one set of terms, I would never have managed it with a relatively small team. So if I was speaking to a bank in the US or anywhere and they didn't want to accept the contract, then they had to exit the tender. At the time, Jaguar Land Rover was going like that, and actually you could use that power to force banks into accepting the contract that you had written rather than accepting one that they'd written. So that's my background. And then I left Jaguar Land Rover, and we're probably going to talk about what I've done since then anyway in the rest of this session.
I mean, fascinating career. And then obviously, you know, you've had a fascinating startup career as well, I guess, chapter two or chapter three of your career, in terms of, you know, you're now a chairman in three startups, namely Tomorrow's Journey, Credit Car and RideCharge. All quite different businesses at different stages of evolution. But what do you think are the key strategies you've had to employ as a chairman to guide these companies towards their
specific growth and innovation targets, whilst at the same time having unique challenges in each business, which, you know, sometimes are common for a lot of startups as well. What's the kind of ingredients, the common skill set across these different businesses?
You know, some of these skill sets that you gain from working in large corporates are not easily transferable to smaller corporates, but, you know, some of them are. And I think one of the skill sets I've got is maybe a slightly longer term vision from the entrepreneurs that you deal with when you're looking at new start businesses. And they often want to do things and they don't think about the consequences. And, you know, when you've been around the block a few times like I have, you know, when you're, you know, either going to, you know, start dealing with a new customer perhaps, or you're going to pivot your business to do something else. I think what I've been able to do is to actually say, well, you know, you really got to think what this looks like in 6 months, 9 months or 12 months and stop them. I use the phrase frequently, don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. And I've seen that with all the businesses I'm chairman of, that they, you know, one thing isn't working particularly well, so I've been there and let's go on to something else. And I think if you say, well, actually, let's look at the reasons why that's not working and don't just simply throw that with the baby with the bathwater. To see if we can fix it. If we can't fix it, then fine. But a little bit more stability, a little bit more long-term thinking, a little bit more sanity. And I think that's what a chairman brings with a lot of these guys who are great. They've got loads of skills, but they're, you know, they're running at 1,000 miles an hour. And sometimes you have to slow them down to, you know, to 20 miles an hour just to think a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously a very emotional journey and very unique to that founder as well. But sounds like the skills that you've kind of honed in your career and skills honed as a chairman is a huge asset to all of these businesses. But in terms of your personal skill set, what new skills have you learned within these chairman roles over the last few years? You know, things that you might not have expected you've become better at or suddenly learned?
Well, one skill I didn't have when I became in my first chairman's role was actually fundraising, because I'd always worked for a large corporate. Frankly, whatever you do, you're going to get paid at the end of the month. With all three businesses, they're all... they've all had their moments when, you know, cash flow has become the number one priority. And certainly I've been involved in fundraising with all three. So that's something that I had to learn. I had to learn about SEIS, EIS. I had to learn to front up the businesses working with guys like you, Mike, you know, who are potential investors and venture capitalists. And, you know, guys like you can be really hard work. And, you know, I've been in quite a few meetings with the entrepreneurs, and they come out of the meetings and they are really frustrated by the level of questioning and so on and so forth. And then when you get into due diligence, so then that kind of frustration picks up even more. So I've learned a lot about that. I've learned a lot about the importance of getting the right information in the data room. I've learned a lot about listening to what the VCs want, and they're not all the same. Some VCs they focus on one thing and some focus on another. But, you know, there are similarities between all of them. So all of them, you know, they really concentrate very hard on the financial aspects of the due diligence. They always want to have a CFO in place if you haven't got one, regardless of the size of the business. So that's always a demand from them. And also there's, you know, the other issues are that you can negotiate is how much involvement they want in the business, how much control they want. It's not, and the control is not just the amount of the equity, how many board meetings do they want, who do they want to appoint, and so on and so forth. And those areas are often fairly, you know, fairly difficult. And I've learned a lot about how to negotiate my way around those demands that from the VC's perspective are reasonable, but from the entrepreneur's perspective are extremely unreasonable.
No, you get a lot of different emotions, and I guess as chairman you've got to kind of manage it on both sides to ensure there's a, you know, an optimal solution so companies can be well funded and entrepreneurs can unleash their potential as well. It's definitely not an easy job. I can appreciate that.
Sorry, just on that point, that's a skill that I gained in certainly at Jaguar Land Rover, because at Jaguar Land Rover we have 50 odd bank partners around the world. Some of them were very big, Chase, in the US, you know, Lloyd's Black Horse in the UK. They were big banks. And, you know, my role was to obviously to manage the contract, but also to maintain that contract and ensure that the bank worked with the with the OEM. And there were many, many times where what the OEM were asking for was unreasonable. And I had to actually stand up against the OEM and say, actually, you can't, the bank won't do this because it's an unreasonable request for the bank. And they would say, get annoyed, you know, say, well, who'd you work for? So, and I said, well, you know, I might work for Jaguar Land Rover. You might want this today, but trust me, in the long term, this is not a good thing to ask for because, you know, if you get it, it will come back and bite you. So I kind of learned those skills, being able to sit on the fence and sometimes actually say no to your employer when they were asking something that was actually not a reasonable request.
Obviously, you've got a deep background in car finance and, you know, clearly there's some significant challenges, but also maybe some long-term opportunities in the sector at this moment in time as well. But in your view, I'd love to hear your current synopsis of where we are in car finance and how you think companies might position themselves for success. And then maybe as a follow-up on that, what are the major trends that you see might, you know, shape the future of automotive finance as well, and how can a business best prepare for that? I'd just love to tap your knowledge on that sector, because there's so much going on at the moment.
There's a huge amount going on at the moment. A lot of it is from the financial services perspective is probably considered to be fairly negative. You've got massive changes in regulation going on at the moment. That started probably in January 2021 when DIC was banned, Difference in Commission was banned, Discretionary Commission was banned. Subsequent to that, you've seen the implementation of Consumer Duty last summer. This year, or back end of last year, you saw the start of the investigation by the FCA into Discretionary Commission, and also the FCA over the past month have completely banned the sale of gap insurance. So regulation has become probably number one priority for the financial services industry. For the auto manufacturers, we work very closely with financial services, is probably the transition to electric vehicles that's the number one issue for them. And linked to that, it's the march of the Chinese, all these Chinese brands that are coming into the market. So the other big thing that's happening that's kind of an umbrella over all those is digitalization. And it's really interesting that only last week, you know, that Cazoo had pulled out of selling cars. And it was a really interesting kind of discussion at last week's meeting in Gaydon with, was it Motor Finance, is it? Or a motor dealer, I think. And Catherine Fayers, who's the CEO of Autotrader, she said that she was arguing that actually online car retailing is dead, and what customers want is omnichannel. And I've been talking about that. You know, I do a lot of work with Asset Finance Connect. I've been talking about omnichannel being the future for a very long time. And it looks, I'm not saying that I'm right on everything, but it certainly looks like I made that right call many, many years ago, that actually customers, most customers don't want to buy a car completely online. But I think from financial services perspective, I think online, the online retailing of financial services makes a lot of sense, because there are so many compliance hurdles to jump over. And if you have a completely online journey, you can ensure that the right questions are asked. If the customer misses the questions, he has to go, or she has to go back and answer them. And you get a digital audit trail of everything that's been done, every kind of interaction between the finance company, the dealer, and the customer. And I think that's really, really important. But at the same time, you know, touching and feeling and smelling the car is really important. So I think the secret for me is a completely seamless online to offline journey, and all the stuff that's heavily compliance led, like financial services, really lives much better in the online space. And the other stuff, you know, the touchy feely stuff lives much better in the offline space. But it's the merging of those two together, and a lot of brands do it quite well. Other brands not so well. And of course, you've had agency, and agency is, you know, pushing it more online. And that's why I think agency is really going to struggle, because most customers don't want that completely online experience. And you've seen The only one that's really running agency, I think, fully is really having a go at it is Mercedes-Benz. Everybody else has either pulled back from it completely or has delayed it. So so the jury's definitely out for me on agency.
Yeah. I mean, I think I've always followed, advised, invested in startups where I know they've put the customer journey to the heart of the proposition, because I think if you put your customer first and there's tangible benefits that they can receive, it tends to be a long-term recipe for success. Not always, of course, but I think, you know, not to have that as a starting principle, I think, is difficult, whether you're selling cars, selling finance, selling parts, you know. But as you say, the industry, it's such an intricate ecosystem throughout such a vast period of change, and the speed of that change is accelerating at the moment. So it's just a fascinating time, really, isn't it? But car finance, I think there must be long-term opportunities to emerge once clearly some short-term changes, you know, will have been made. And in terms of,
I can work for a few more years then if it's got a future. That's great.
I'm sure there will be more companies that will need your skill set, particularly in that sector, over the next couple of years, David. So I don't think you need to worry about that.
That's very kind of you, Mike.
Finally, what advice would you give to budding entrepreneurs that want to kind of follow in the successful footsteps of some of the successful growth startups that you now chair? What would be the kind of key bits of advice you give to these budding entrepreneurs?
Okay, so I think in all three businesses, I've had to sit down with the owners of the business, and from the very beginning, I think first of all, if you're going to have a new start business, what I don't think you should do is set the business up, run at a million miles an hour, and then think, oh, I was going to swear then, but then think, let's go and appoint a chairman, or let's go and appoint an advisor or somebody like that, because I think it's far better if you appoint the chairman or your advisor at the very beginning. You bring that person in at the very beginning. The second thing that's really important, I think, is that if you're going to be a chairman of a business, I think it's really important that you believe in what the business is. You don't just do it for the money or the equity. You've got to really believe in the vision of the entrepreneur. And I've been offered other chairman's jobs that I've not taken because I didn't really think the product had a future. The second thing that's really important is you've got to really like the people that you're working with, because if you're going to become the chairman of us, I mean, Tomorrow's Journey is not a small business anymore. It's got 30-odd people and so on and so forth. The other two are small, but you've got to really like the people that are running the business, because you know, as a chairman, there's going to be times when you're going to have to say, hang on a minute, you know, we're not going to do it that way, you know, or we're not going to appoint that person, or we're not going to do this, or we're going to actually get rid of this customer, and so on and so forth. And, you know, you have to be prepared to make those decisions. But knowing the person beforehand, you know that relationship is going to be able to withstand those stresses and strains that you're clearly going to have, down the line. And the third area is that you have to ensure that you've got a proper business plan that's properly constructed, and the focus has not just got to be on revenue. It's got to be obviously very much on expenses, but the focus has got to be very much on cash flow. And you've got to make sure that your reporting on cash flow is really, really sound. That you look very closely at every meeting, at runway, and so on and so forth. And what you've got to do is, when you're looking at the runway and looking at when the money's run out, you've got to really decide when does the CEO of that business, when does he or she need to start raising more funds? Because it takes a while. It's incredibly time consuming and draining for the CEO, who just wants to drive the business, but they have to get involved in fundraising. So I think knowing when you've got to start your fundraising is really, really important. And as part of that, you know, you absolutely do need a really fully fledged business plan to do that. And those are the areas where I've seen probably most strain is in around cash flow from time to time, and actually the amount of time and effort that it takes to actually raise more funds, and that's where I think most of the strains are in the businesses that I've been running for the last 4 or 5 years now.
Most is just hugely valuable, and I think I can see that's going to keep you busy for many years to come, David, I think. So
And the other important thing is if you're going to become a chairman of a business, I think finally it's really important that you invest some of your own money. So when you're talking to people who might want to invest, they'll say, well, you know, I think it's important you become a director as well as the chairman, but also that you are seen to invest your own money. And in all three businesses, I mean, I'm not wealthy, but I'm not poor. But I mean, I've invested a reasonable amount in all three businesses, and it's pretty tax efficient to do that, as you know, using SEIS and so forth. So, but it's really important that you put your money where your mouth is. That's I think anybody's listening in is going to be a chairman has to be prepared to actually to invest some of their own money and risk it. But if you've done your homework well, and you believe in the vision of the business and you believe in the people that you're going to be working with, those are two really big risks that you've taken out of the equation.
Yeah. No, David, that's great advice, and very much appreciate your time on this. It's much appreciated. Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed. If you want to listen to more episodes of the podcast, we're on all good audio platforms. Our website is also www.cambriaprivatecapital.com, and you can also find myself on LinkedIn and Twitter, where we publish our weekly blogs as well. Please do get in touch if you want more information.